TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Michael Parenti, Fascism, the False Revolution. A talk given by the political analyst and author Michael Parenti in 1995 sounds almost as if it was given in 2017 in the context of European and US elections. In his 50-plus years of lecturing at major universities, Parenti returned many times to the important connection between capitalism and fascism. Actually, over 32,000 times, if you believe the search engines. Fascism, as Mussolini said, should be more properly called corporatism, since it is the merger of state and corporate power, end quote. And history, as told by Michael Parenti, shows that in all fascist societies, be it Italy, Germany, Japan, Spain, and into the present, corporate power increased. And that gain in power, such as tax cuts, deregulation, subsidies for extraction of oil and minerals, involves a loss of power, rights, environmental and workplace protection, and wages for those who work for a living. Parenti, who grew up in an Italian-American working-class family in New York City and earned his PhD in political science from Yale, was familiar with Benito Mussolini from childhood on. Some members of his working-class family admired Mussolini. Others were ready to fight fascism in World War II. Parenti wasn't even a teen when war was begun. 5.5 decades later, he begins this lecture about the false revolution of fascism with a brief history of the origins of fascism in Italy and Germany. Michael Parenti.
I want to look at some of the neglected attributes of fascism and its relevance for what's happening today. Before World War I, Benito Mussolini was a socialist. But many of his socialist comrades thought he was less interested in advancing the cause of socialism than in advancing himself. And sure enough, the minute that the wealthy classes in Italy offered him financial support and the promise of power, he didn't hesitate to switch sides. We know about people who switch sides, don't we? And with the huge sums he got from wealthy interests, Mussolini was able to project himself onto the national scene as the acknowledged leader of I Fasci di Combattimento, it was called, a movement composed of ex-army officers and various other toughs who were used as a kind of anti-labor militia. They specialized in attacking unions, peasant farm cooperatives, socialists, communists, and anarchists. After World War I, Italy's parliamentary government faced a post-war recession. To maintain profit levels, the large industrialists and big landowners would have to slash wages and raise prices. The state, in turn, would have to provide the big owners with massive subsidies and tax exemptions. To finance this corporate welfareism, the populace would have to be taxed more heavily and social welfare expenditures would have to be drastically cut. Does all of this sound familiar? But the government wasn't completely free to apply these harsh measures because many Italian workers and peasants had their own unions and fairly strong political organizations with demonstrations, strikes, boycotts, factory takeovers, the forcible occupation of farmlands, and all these things. They won some substantial concessions in wages, in work conditions, and in the right to organize. So the workers and peasants were able to mount a defense of their standard of living. To roll back that standard of living and to get the economic changes that the plutocrats and tycoons wanted, the ruling interests had to abolish the democratic rights that helped workers and peasants defend that standard. So the solution was to smash their organizations and their political liberties. In 1922, the Federazione Industriale, the leaders of industry, along with top bankers and agribusiness associations, met with Mussolini to plan the March on Rome, contributing 20 million lira to the so-called fascist revolution. Within 2 years after seizing state power, Mussolini had shut down all opposition newspapers and crushed the socialist, liberal, Catholic, Democratic, and Republican parties, which together had commanded about 80% of the vote. The fascists were never a majority in Italy. Opposition leaders, union leaders, and others were beaten, exiled, or murdered. The Italian Communist Party endured the severest repression of all. In Germany, there was a very similar pattern of complicity between fascists and capitalists. German workers and farm laborers had won the 8-hour day, unemployment insurance, the right to unionize. They had built very strong political organizations also. But heavy industry and big finance were in a state of nearly total collapse. Business wanted to cut wages. Business wanted tax cuts and massive state subsidies to revive profit levels. During the 1920s, the Nazi stormtroopers were subsidized by business and were used to terrorize workers and farm laborers. But by 1930, a decision was made by the German tycoons, and that decision was that the Weimar Republic no longer served their needs and was too accommodating to the working class and to the Social Democrats. They greatly increased their subsidies to Hitler, and propelling the Nazi Party onto the national stage. In fact, Hitler himself boasted of it, the immense amount of campaign material we got. 1,000 automobiles with loudspeakers, each of them could make 100 appearances, so 100,000 appearances saturating every town and village in the cities of Germany, getting out this propaganda, money to build their party organization, their youth groups, and their paramilitary forces. You can read book after book about fascism and Nazism and find almost nothing said about the economic policies of these regimes, of the things I just told you about now. They're just not in the books. There's also a vast literature on who supported the Nazis. Who supported them? Well, there were some rich tycoons, but some of them were against them. And some workers voted for them and some against them. It's hard to say, blah, 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 stuff. Very little is ever written about who the Nazis supported when they came in, who the fascists supported when they came in. Because that would be much more revealing, you see. And this is in keeping with the tendency of mainstream scholarship to avoid the entire subject of capitalism whenever something unfavorable might be said about it. Well, who did Mussolini and Hitler support once they seized state power? In both countries, a strikingly similar agenda was pursued. Labor unions and strikes were outlawed. Union property and publications were confiscated. Farm cooperatives were handed over to rich private owners. Big agribusiness farming was heavily subsidized. In Italy, child labor was reintroduced. In both Germany and Italy, the already modest wages of the workers were cut drastically. In Germany, from 25 to 40% cuts. In Italy, 50%. Wages cut. These were already rather modest wages as it was. In both countries, minimum wage laws, overtime pay, and factory safety regulations were abolished or turned into dead letters. Taxes were increased for the general populace, but lowered or eliminated for the rich and big business. Inheritance taxes for the wealthy were greatly reduced or abolished. Both Mussolini and Hitler showed their gratitude to their business patrons by handing over to them publicly owned and perfectly solvent steel mills, power plants, banks, steamship companies. Privatization, it's called. Privatization. Both regimes dipped heavily into the public treasury to refloat or subsidize heavy industry. Corporate welfareism, we would call it today. Both states guaranteed a return on the capital invested by giant corporations and assumed most of the risks and losses on investment. Sounds like savings and loan, if you ask me. As in all reactionary regimes, public capital was raided by private capital. The result of all of this? In Italy during the 1930s, the economy was gripped by recession, a staggering public debt, widespread corruption, but industrial profits rose. And the armaments factories busily rolled out the weapons. In Germany, unemployment was eased somewhat because there was a massive depression when they came in. And it was eased because of the massive arms program and the arms spending. But generally, poverty increased. I mean, if you cut wages 25 to 40%, poverty has increased no matter how many jobs you might create. But from 1935 to 1943, the net income of German corporate leaders rose 46%. In both countries, the conditions of labor deteriorated greatly. Speed-ups, dismissals, imprisonment for workers who complained about unsafe or inhumane work conditions, longer hours for less wages. You know, looking at this years ago, I used to say that fascism never really succeeded in solving the irrational contradictions of capitalism. Today, I believe it was never intended to solve the irrational contradictions of capitalism, at least not for the populace and for the people. Now I'm of the opinion that it actually, in a way, did succeed. It succeeded in solving the problems of capitalism, but only for the capitalists. Fascism offers a reactionary solution, not a social solution, to the contradictions of capitalism. It forces all the burdens and losses onto the working public. And in those days, by the way, there was any number of U.S. bankers and industrialists, including the likes of Henry Ford, who appreciated the way fascism was serving the moneyed class, and they were avid admirers. They gave political and even financial support to Mussolini and Hitler. The U.S. press was also filled with admiration. Fortune magazine, the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Chicago Tribune, you know, the free and independent press that speaks for all of us. They hailed Il Duce as the man who rescued Italy from radicalism and brought perfect harmony to the country. The image of an Italy in a state of perfect harmony is one that challenges the imagination in any case. In regard to Hitler, the U.S. press in the 1930s had a rather substantial contingent of give Adolf a chance group, you know, let's give Adolf a chance. He means well. Oh, he may be a little rough here or there, but some of that sympathy was greased directly by Nazi money. You know, Hearst entered a deal with the Nazis, he had his wire service. The Nazis paid him something like 10 times the normal subscription, and in response, Hearst fired any reporters who filed negative stories and admonished the others to treat the Nazi Germany in a nice light. Gray Brechin told me that he found back issues of Hearst newspapers that contained guest columns by Nazi leaders like Alfred Rosenberg and Hermann Göring. So, I mean, we're talking thick here. They were thick, you know. As the war clouds gathered, as Italy, Germany, and Japan, who were the late comers in the industrial world, began to challenge the interests of the more established Western capitalist nations, then press coverage begins to get a little more critical. Now, some mainstream writers and academics and scholars, quote, not only deny fascism's close collaboration with big business, they even argue that business was one of the victims of fascism. Angelo Codevilla, a Hoover Institute right-wing flack, blithely announcing in Commentary magazine, August 94, quote, if fascism means anything, it means government ownership and control of business. And he goes on and says, so business doesn't like fascism. They often try to misrepresent fascism as a mutant form of socialism. In fact, if fascism means anything, it means government support and subsidy for business, mass privatization, and intensified exploitation and repression of labor, in a word. Fascist and Nazi leaders did not merely serve the capitalists, they also served themselves. I mean, they were unprincipled people. Mussolini lived like a king. Hitler is portrayed to us as an ascetic fanatic, a devoted ideologue who wasn't concerned with material things. Yeah, sure. In fact, Hitler accumulated an immense fortune, much of it in very shady ways. During his entire tenure in office, he avoided paying any income taxes or property taxes and got special rulings from the German tax office. The letters are very amusing. Yes, yes, we see no reason for you. You have heavy state expenditures, yes, no taxes for you, mein Führer. He expropriated artworks from the public domain. He stole enormous sums from Nazi party coffers, including endowments and donations, small ones, big ones. He took a lot of it for himself. He invented a new concept. It was called the personality right. He charged a minute fraction of a fee for every postage stamp that was sold that had his picture on it. And he made hundreds of millions of marks. The greatest source of Hitler's wealth was from a secret slush fund to which German industrialists regularly donated. Wolf Schwarzweller, in a book about Hitler's private fortune, quote, "Hitler knew that as long as German industry was making money, his private money sources would be inexhaustible. Thus, he would see to it that German industry was never better off than under his rule, by launching, for one thing, gigantic armaments projects, or what we would call today defense contracts, right? Hitler lived self-indulgently. He had a motor pool of limousines, private apartments, country homes, a vast staff of servants, a majestic estate in the Alps. He was a snob. His happiest times were when he was entertaining European royalty, including the Duke and Duchess of Windsor, who themselves were delighted to be his guests. There are photos of them all like this, shaking hands and looking adoringly at each other. Well, come on, Parenti, is that all fascism is, a conspiracy to save capitalism? Well, that might not be all that it is, but that's quite an important part of it. So could we talk about that once in a while? It's the part that Hitler himself kept referring to when he talked about saving the industrialists and bankers from Bolshevism. Mussolini also designated himself Italy's savior from the red tide. But what was exactly so terrible about communism was not that it threatened democracy. The Italian fascists and German Nazis both openly detested democracy, and they destroyed it when they came to power in any case. The industrialists, those guys weren't worried about democracy being taken over. It was that communism and the left in general was never strong enough to take state power in either country, but they were strong enough to interfere with profit rates and the capital accumulation process, and this was threatening enough for the moneyed interests. Now, I don't want to deny fascism's ideology and its irrational appeals, but even these irrational elements had a rational class control function. You know, I've said it many times that much of politics is the rational manipulation of irrational symbols. Because you got the irrational symbols, it doesn't mean that the people who are putting them out don't know what they're doing, that they're just stupid and we are the only ones who know. In fascism, look at these so irrational appeals. There's the atavistic appeals. Go back to the mythical roots of our people. For Mussolini, it was going back to the grandeur that was Rome. For Hitler, the ancient folk. There's the cult of the leader, Il Duce, the Führer. In fact, the Nazis called it der Führerprinzip, the leader principle. With leader worship and state worship, there's the glorification of militarism, war, and conquest. But these are all basically conservative symbols, you see. These are all basically to get people distracted from their own immediate interests, political, economic, class interests, and get them galvanized into this kind of thing, the war, the conquest, the militarism. Most of the Italian army, in fact, the ordinary recruits, putting the black shirt fanatics aside, most of the Italian recruits had no taste for war whatsoever. So the fascist doctrines do stress these monistic values. Oneness, ein Volk, ein Reich, ein Führer. One people, one state, one leader. The people are no longer to be concerned with class divisions, but they must see themselves as part of a harmonious authoritarian whole, a view that's very supported of the socioeconomic status quo. This is very much in contrast to a left agenda, which advocates a sharpened awareness of class injustice and class struggle, the articulation of popular demands, and the self-generated participation of popular forces. Fascism, especially the Nazi version, had an explicit commitment to racism, as you all know. Human attributes are said to be inherited through blood. Genetics and biology are said to justify the existing class structure, just as our academic racists today are doing with their bell curve theories and their warmed over eugenics claptrap and all that stuff they're meddling in. Fascism also supports sexual inequality and homophobia. The oppression of gays was often criminal and homicidal. The oppression of women was traditionally patriarchal. Mussolini, quote, "A man is not a man unless he is a husband, a father, and a soldier, giving orders in the first two roles and taking orders in the third. Woman's greatest calling is to tend to the needs of her husband and children, producing as many as she can for the state." Children, not husbands. This patriarchal ideology, I would maintain, is linked to a conservative class ideology. If women get out of line, what will happen to the family? If the family goes, then the entire social structure is at risk. And if the social structure unravels, what will happen to my position, my privileges, my wealth? That's still the concern today in this country. I mean, do you really think that right-wing leaders who talk about family values care about the family? Let's take three of the most outspoken proponents most recently who I've heard mouthing off about family values: Phil Gramm, Bob Dole, and Newt Gingrich. You know? Well, you know what those three, I don't want to get ad hominem, but one thing those three all have in common is they all left their wives and kids and ran off with other women. But a lot of people get divorced. More important, the other thing they have in common is they're all pursuing and advocating policies that are very harmful to the family and very harmful to children and the whole task of raising children. So they use the issue to mobilize voter sentiment and to evade economic issues. In Nazi Germany, racism, anti-Semitism were used, as you know, to rechannelize some legitimate grievances to irrelevant enemies, scapegoating, as we would call it. Many middle-class Germans, they knew they were victimized by very powerful economic forces, but they were too bound up in the conventional social order to really adopt a revolutionary course. They couldn't do that, so they went in a fascist direction. They started voting for the Nazi parties. To the extent, by the way, that the Nazis had any kind of mass base, it was among the middle and upper middle class. Some of the photos of Nazi audiences are very revealing. The people are very well dressed. This image that Hitler went among the common people is really rather questionable. It was a combination of middle class, petty bourgeois, and some lumpenpro. There was a lumpenpro, beer hall, rabble, and those people who became the stormtroopers, as a matter of fact, who did have a kind of a leftish position, as I'll talk about in a minute. Not more than 1/4 to 1/3, it varied from elections, not more than 1/4 to 1/3 of the organized workers ever voted for the Nazi Party. The overwhelming majority voted for the Communist parties or the Social Democrats. Now, anti-Semitic propaganda was very emotive and irrational, but it was cleverly crafted to appeal to certain groups. So to workers and peasants, they were told, it's the Jewish capitalists who are doing this, the Jewish usurers. To the middle class, they were told, it's the Jewish trade union leaders and the Jewish communists who are doing this. To the super patriots, the Jew is the enemy alien and internationalist and the like. So it depended on the group, and you see the propaganda really was crafted and leaned a certain way to make very definite appeals. So the Nazis, they may have been crazy, but they weren't stupid. Again, it's what I was saying, the rational use of irrational symbols and arguments. What distinguishes fascism from ordinary right-wing autocracies, which today are also called fascism, we call just about every right-wing repressive, and I think justifiably because they fulfill the same function ultimately, but what distinguished fascism was the way it attempted to cultivate a revolutionary aura and give the impression of being a mass movement. Fascism offers a really beguiling mix of revolutionary-sounding mass appeals and reactionary class politics. You want to sum it up. The Nazi Party's full name, as you know, was the National Socialist German Workers' Party. I mean, they very consciously left-sounding, stealing the thunder of the left in various ways. The stormtroopers had a share-the-wealth mentality. And in fact, after Hitler came into power, the SA, the brown shirts, was suppressed because they were waiting to divide up some of the wealth. Both the Italian fascists and the Nazis made a conscious effort at imitating the left. Youth organizations, mass mobilizations, rallies, parades, banners, symbols, slogans, uniforms. And I think for this reason, too, many mainstream writers treat fascism and communism as totalitarian twins. People like A. James Gregor, people like William Ebenstein in that popularizing book of his, Today's Isms, which is now in its eighth edition and used in so many schools. And every time I look at it, I go, oh, God, what a book. They talk about this sort of thing. They pretend they can't tell the difference between fascism and communism. But most workers and peasants could tell the difference. Industrialists and bankers could tell the difference. And certainly the communists and the fascists themselves could tell the difference. I'll give you a more recent example, non-academic example of this kind of obfuscation. It's from that crypto-fascist himself, John Paul II, the CIA pope. In 1989, the pontiff pontificated, quote, Nazi paganism and Marxist dogma are both basically totalitarian ideologies and tend to become substitute religions. So what he's doing here, what all these people are doing is reducing essence to form. That is taking a few similarities of form and ignoring then the enormous differences in actual political content and class commitment. Fascism, in fact, is a false revolution. It makes a revolutionary appeal without making an actual revolution. It propagates the widely proclaimed new order while serving the same old moneyed interests.
That was the first half of a one-hour lecture on fascism, the false revolution, by Dr. Michael Parenti. In spite of the many references that apply to the present, as of 2017, this talk was given to a standing room audience of 1,200 in Berkeley, California, on September 23, 1995. Michael Parenti received his PhD in political science from Yale. He is the author of 23 books and many more articles. His works have been translated into at least 18 languages. Parenti consciously gave up the opportunity for an academic career. He publicly opposed the war in Vietnam, was arrested, and lost his position. Parenti decided to become an independent author, lecturer, and activist, and has taught in the U.S. and abroad. Come back for the conclusion of Fascism, the False Revolution, when TUC Radio returns. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio is free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.